Welcome to Dark Mood Woods, a Twin Peaks podcast. This is Ethan.
And this is Nick.
Thank you for joining me, Nicholas, and
thank you for hosting me, Ethan. Well, co-hosting. Let's not let the stratas of power overtake us just yet.
Is anyone really egotistical because of a podcast?
Oh, many people. Absolutely.
True. Actually, I guess if you have a Patreon.
Yeah.
But well, this is episode one. Like, it's here. 2 hours for some people, 4 hours for others. But specifically today, we will be discussing the first 2 hours, which aired on Showtime last night. Nick, how about you start? Talk about your viewing environment.
Yes, so my viewing environment was in someone's apartment. It was an interesting setup because there were multiple people there, and I ended up having to sit on a hardwood floor, which is, of course, not ideal, but the anticipation of it, and I think the quality of the program itself, essentially made up for that. I was fairly enraptured throughout, even as the room was maybe getting a bit warm, and my body was getting a little sore from sitting there for 2 hours. Even this extremely slow, extremely opaque project was holding me pretty tightly. And it was a fairly respectful viewing environment, I would say. There was some yassing going on at certain characters' appearances. And, you know, there were some whispers of, "This is incredible," every several minutes, which I appreciated. I thought that was nice. But yeah, it was an interesting way to start off. I also was able to see it on a big television with good sound, with the lights down, which is, I think, exactly how David Lynch would prefer it.
Did anyone lean over to you, point at the screen, and say, "That's Twin Peaks"?
No, unfortunately.
They could have. Well, in terms of my viewing environment, I watched it in a friend's basement, or kind of the screening room, you could say, in his apartment. I brought Krispy Kreme donuts. I bought six because apparently there was going to be four people, but it only ended up being us two. So we had to split the donuts, and it was a lot of sugar, which got me very amped, I feel like. But I will say I live streamed the show, so the quality was, let's just say there was a lot of digital noise in the picture and a few buffering issues, but thankfully few, and really only in the first episode. How was the feeling when the first note of falling kicked in for you?
You know, it's a funny thing to finally see something that you've been anticipating for so long, because there's such a weight that is carried in every second and every gesture of the thing. It's kind of as if you've been told there's some great secret, and finally the secret is being revealed to you. And that's appropriate for a project that is so built on secrets and their allure and the effect they can have. So, yeah, even just the theme starting up, there was kind of this rush where I thought to myself, this is actually here. This is finally here. This is very difficult to believe. And it's funny because I felt that, I don't know how our listeners experienced it, but for me, the Showtime setup was maybe a bit unideal, because it seemed as if it was starting, and then, oh no, it's an advertisement for this show about stand-up comedians, and then it seems it's starting, and oh, there's the guy from Billions riding a motorcycle.
Oh yeah.
It seems as if it's starting, and then there's this weird preemptory stock footage from the original series. And I think when the Showtime logo came up, somebody went, "Oh, come on already," because we were just so jacked up in anticipation. Yes, we also did bring donuts. I brought donuts to the place, and I thought, oh, I'll be creative. It turns out that there were 24 donuts there already. So there were plenty to go around. We were all definitely jazzed up. And then, yeah, once it starts up, there was just this, again, it's kind of this feeling of, I have rewatched large sections of the first two episodes. The second episode, I rewatched basically the whole second half of. And I feel that I need to, because again, when it comes to a project that you've anticipating, there is that feeling of, it's difficult to even process it as it should be processed. During the first sequence, which is the giant and Cooper in the lodge, I was kind of like, okay, this is interesting, but also sort of what I was expecting. I figured the first scene would be Dale Cooper in the Black Lodge. And then as soon as we go into the sequence in New York City, which is the actor Ben Rosenfield staring at a box, adjusting cameras, the sequence playing out very, very slowly with these long, languid takes of him getting up from a couch, going down a little flight of stairs, going to this console, opening the console, putting in some sort of memory card, closing the console, going back up the stairs, sitting on the couch, staring at the box, wash, rinse, repeat. There I was thinking, not only are we on business, but I'm very excited because this is not the Twin Peaks that people remember. This is not it at all, in fact. This is something of an entirely different stripe. Yet it feels very Lynchian. In fact, I would say it feels more Lynchian than most of Twin Peaks does. And that was very exciting. And then I was held in pretty rapt attention throughout, even during some of the stretches where I was very unsure as to precisely, A, what was happening, B, why it was happening. I was still just this sense of, again, something being revealed to me. And then it spiked with more, I think, obvious pleasures. What else can you really say about the Bad Cooper's introductory sequence, which is sort of a Lost Highway kind of redux, which I don't just say because of the shot, the POV shot of the car, but even the music that's playing, which is apparently a remix of American Woman that David Lynch did, which I couldn't recognize as I was hearing it. I honestly thought it was sort of a Trent Reznor track or something. And some deformed people show up too, which is great. I love when Lynch and deformed people get together. And that was all kind of a lot to take. And with that, I think I'll sort of hand it off to you as we continue this discussion.
Well, I mean, I can say you mentioned New York. I mean, not just this once it cut to New York, once it specifically cut to a digital landscape of New York, I had a he's doing it feeling, if you know what I mean. I mean, the first actual scene in Twin Peaks 2 is Jacoby, and this whole scene too, which is shot basically at an extreme distance, which I think where you get the first indication that there will be no fan service at all, I feel like.
Right. Also the fact that the character's most identifiable trait, which are his glasses, are really backgrounded that way too, where you can't even immediately tell that it's him because of the lighting and the camera distance.
I mean, how would you characterize Bad Cooper's voice?
Bad Cooper's voice, it's Kyle MacLachlan as he has to give somebody some bad news. That's what it sounds like, basically.
Yeah.
Are you trying to do an impersonation here?
I was trying to, but I couldn't really do the actual vocal cadence. I was just trying to grunt, which I don't think he actually grunts, but I'm trying to make a grunt into a voice, really.
Right. Yeah. That was it's funny because it's not really surprising that there is a Bad Cooper. It would only make sense, nor is the brutality of it surprising. But I guess for me, what I find most intriguing is, and this in and of itself is not surprising either, is how little of his doings are explained. He has all these associations with all these people and all these names are coming up, and yet it's not really clear where these lines can be drawn exactly. And the fact that he is so let's think about this. Apparently he's part of some criminal empire, it seems like, or he's even running the criminal empire, and his people around him are trying to take him down, and they might even be be aware of the Black Lodge, which perhaps ties to the fact that this goes to my favorite exchange in the entire two episodes, when the guy played by Ben Rosenfield brings the woman, what's her name again? Do you recall? It's said like 15 times.
I just think of her as Coffee Girl.
I don't know if it's Nancy or something, but it's a thing where it's, well, gee, Nancy, I don't know if you can come in when there's a guard here. But so there's a billionaire who it seems has somehow found a way to harness the energy of the black box and is observing it from some distant location. That's the jibe I was getting there. But maybe there's a connection there, maybe there's not. But nevertheless, there's this... So my favorite exchange in the whole two episodes is in that scene where the girl asks, whose place is this? And he says, I heard a billionaire. which as far as mood and revelation and place setting is classic Lynch through and through.
I like to just think of that young guy too as a guy who's just going to school and needs to pay the bills, and is like, he answered probably that on like, it was like an ad on Craigslist or something.
Yeah. Oh, no, exactly, yeah. And the fact that, again, it's funny because I was watching this with a friend of mine who once proposed to me this idea that in the work of David Lynch, sex is a precedent to or result of something really quite horrible. And in this, the first ever, as far as I can tell, really the first ever sex scene shown on screen in Twin Peaks, the TV series, leads to two people being mauled to death by some kind of J-horror ghost. That comes out of a box.
I won't lie, that sequence reminded me of Fear.com.
Oh, yes, one of your favorites, Fear.com.
Yes, in the Ethan canon.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's one thing that really fascinated me, too, about this is that there's sort of this talk about how... I mean, the thing is, if you look at Lynch's... if you look at pretty much any interview that he does, he seems like a very kind... generous man who believes that people who put art into the world make the world a better place, and that the world needs art to thrive. This is evident in the not just that he's making films, but he's making television, he's making sculptures, music, paintings, cartoons. So I sort of, you know, I don't want to read too much into his intentions, but there is such, he does have such a kind of a shithead prevailing fuck you attitude when he wants to have it. And I couldn't help but think that there was just such a strain of it in this episode, or these episodes, I should say. The fact that, so how many actual quantifiable minutes of this are set in the town of Twin Peaks? Like 7, 8?
10, if I'm being generous.
I mean, really, so you have the hemp cap wearing Jerry Horn, right, who's talking about donuts with Ben Horn. You have, featuring Ashley Judd in a scene as well, which is curious. Then you have Dr. Jacoby receiving some shovels beforehand. Why are we seeing these scenes? Like, why? The last scene makes enough sense. You know, back to the Bang Bang Bar, get a musical performance to end the show. Great, love it. And yet, I watch it, and I'm thinking, okay, what is going on here in terms of placement of time? It's pretty, that to me is one of the most baffling things.
Well, a lot of the pacing of those scenes, too, reminded me of The Missing Pieces, which are, of course, the deleted scenes from the film, which all are essentially scenes that were cut for a good reason, and I think Lynch more filmed them as fan service, and in editing realized they weren't necessary.
Feels not just like an evolution of Lynch's recent-ish work, let's say, from Mulholland Drive onward, but also its difference between Twin Peaks, which is that Lynch is obviously an older man now, and there is something about these first two episodes that recall, and again, maybe I'm reaching here, but they recall the later films of Manuel de Oliveira.
Hell yeah.
Just in the sense of duration in a given scene, and kind of how quiet it is, and how pretty much any action that feels even a bit sudden is almost violent. There's almost a violence to an otherwise standard action because it seems to break apart from a more established, calm thread that is running through it.
Well, I mean, I think most of the compositions even are pretty simple. The cinematography, the lighting is not necessarily super expressive. It does feel kind of like an example, like you said, of late style in a way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But even then, in terms of, even if compositions are simple, there is such a preciseness and a crispness to the compositions themselves. It doesn't really feel as if in any given scene there's a wasted shot, does there? I mean, it doesn't, there aren't unnecessary inserts, there aren't like clunky shot, reverse shot dynamics either. Even just the cutting between those is very crisp, I found. One thing, I was rewatching the sequence wherein Bad Cooper, which is that how we're just going to refer to him now, is Bad Cooper?
How about we call him
Mr. C?
Donnie?
Donnie?
Yeah.
Why Donnie?
That was just the first name that came to mind.
Let's call him, I'll just go with Bad Cooper for now.
Well, what would be the name of the opposite of a cuck?
An alpha? Alpha Cooper?
Let's just call him Alpha Coop.
Okay, Alpha Coop. That's good. Well, so the sequence where... Well, actually, that's a really ugly way to establish this. The sequence where Alpha Coop murders the woman in the hotel room. So during that sequence... Jesus Christ. I was just noting the relationship between the one camera setup more directly facing him, the camera setup more directly facing the woman, and just kind of the volley between them and the tension in the conversation and the sense of foreboding in it. It is fascinating how this is not only his first long-form directorial project in some time, but the fact that really it's his first long-form directorial project with a traditional mise-en-scene to it, because Inland Empire certainly doesn't have that. Inland Empire is a lot of the handheld shots, kind of the forehead-level close-ups, whereas this is, you know, this is more controlled, or I don't want to say controlled because I love Inland Empire. I'll say it's more traditional. It's closer to traditional than that. And just the crispness of that was really, really impressive. And I'm wondering how that's going to carry through in the forthcoming episodes, just because there are 16 more hours of this. And and it's funny because at the viewing event I went to, both myself and people, you know, Lynch fans and, you know, film critics alike, all of us, even as we were enjoying it, we were watching it going, is this going to run all summer? Like, this is really going to go on. It's like, what is even going to happen? Now, I say that having not seen yet the two episodes that follow it. I know that you, Ethan, have.
Yes, I'm being coy.
We will discuss them Sue, and probably later this week. Just, you know, I would like to hear your perspective on these two episodes a bit more in relation to the two episodes that you've seen, if it's possible to frame it that way without conceding too much information.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things we talked about on the last episode, the preamble episode of sorts, is how we, and a lot of people too, were expecting this to kind of be Fire Walk With Me, the show. And I think the first two episodes do set this certain tone and really a certain tempo. Everything plays at this glacial pace, and there is some humor. But the next two episodes, I will say to preview, threw the tone I thought the show was going to have so out the window that I'm just even more excited for what the hell the show is going to be.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. No, I've heard some things about it because, unfortunately, you know, you go on Twitter the morning after and it's kind of like navigating a minefield. So you have to be a little careful there. But, okay. Good. Good.
Well, I wanted to break up a few of the people that showed up on the cast list. I think when the cast list was announced last year, one of the most puzzling names was Matthew Lillard, who... I mean, he's someone, I guess, is eked out like kind of a somewhat respectable character actor career, but I think most people, you know, think of him as the crazy over actor from Scream or Shaggy from the two Scooby-Doo movies. But I think his casting in this as just another kind of Lynchian example of the kind of middle class, average American, middle-aged white guy who mm-hmm. possibly possesses an evil interior is... Mwah.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, it's funny, too, how the original show, I think, is often... I think part of the reason it's... I would go so far as to say I know part of the reason it's canonized is because the cast is so sexy from top to bottom, basically. No pun intended in top to bottom. And I was thinking to myself how, you know, like a lot of the people on this just look more like regular people. And it's not afraid to let its actors age either. When James Marshall shows up at the end of the episode, which I actually found quite moving, honestly.
Me too.
I wasn't expecting that, but something about the fact that the character who's notoriously the most sullen guy in the entire town of Twin Peaks, even more sullen than the people whose daughter have been murdered, he shows up smiling, and he's got some kid. It's either his son or like his mentor or something, and he's enjoying himself. And
no,
Shelley's...
it's the idea of his son possibly as his wingman is a little depressing.
Well, is it his wingman? Is it not? We'll see. We'll see. Nevertheless, that's a very depressing thought. Nevertheless, and then Shelley, who shows up again very briefly, says, James is still cool. He's always been cool. Which, if that's not, I mean, come on. If that's not Lynch and Frost nodding directly to the fandom, I don't even know what to do with that line. Like, if that's not him again in this self-reflexive mode, I would be pretty stunned. Like, that requires a level of obliviousness that is unprecedented, right? There is a certain generosity to watching this. Although there is still I can't get over the fact that Laura Palmer shows up for one scene and then she gets sucked into space or something. And just the sound of it is so horrifying, and just her screaming as she's being sort of, it's almost as if she's a balloon that's being deflated and shot in the air.
You think of her as someone too, considering the film, who's sort of endured enough. So, having that additional.
Exactly. What is happening there? Or Leland Palmer shows up as well, looking quite horrible, I would say. I mean, not that Ray Weiss himself looks terrible physically, just he looks extremely distressed. And yeah, the sense that for me was a really interesting crystallization of time having passed on this show.
Well, we should mention, sorry to interrupt you, but I think maybe the best example of this is the Log Lady cameo.
Yeah, which is, I mean, yeah, that's a thing where Catherine Coulson, who of course plays the Log Lady, had died in late September of 2015, something like a month after the show started shooting, and there was speculation as to whether or not she'd even be in it. And then when she made the cast list, that was kind of a surprise to people. And one would have to imagine those scenes were shot pretty early, because she does look, I mean, she looks very sick. There's no two ways about it. But also just the fact that, again, the whole idea of this being, if not necessarily fuck you, a rejigging, sort of a tantamount to the TV smash of being a Firewalk with Me, is the fact that the only reference to coffee and pie in this comes from her, as she's very sick, and she's making this kind of sad plea for somebody to come over and visit her in her dying days. That was really kind of jolting, I would say. There was a certain layer of unsparingness and yet affection. I think there's still a certain tenderness in allowing her to have this thing that maybe sets the series in motion, but still the effect of seeing her is fairly strong in that way. And in a way it wouldn't be if there wasn't this layer of, I don't want to say metafiction to it, but there is a thin layer between actor and character in those instances. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also, yeah, just the sense of time having passed is, I think, really underlined by the presence of Laura and Leland Palmer, because you're watching it and you think to yourself, what exactly has Cooper been doing for 25 years sitting in the lodge? There's no indication he's been doing anything other than sitting there. And even the way he sort of delivers his lines, he seems tired, and he seems... I think Kyle MacLachlan so far has been really spectacular in these. I mean, he seems to be, tired and wanting to sort of get on with it, or at least just be done with it. And then, of course, you have Alpha Coop out there doing what he's doing. Yeah, oh yeah.
Have we even mentioned, too, there's one recasting they essentially had to get around, and I think they did it in a pretty spectacular fashion.
Oh, dear. Yeah, so maybe let's set the scene a little bit as to that, because I think a bit of context makes it even more amusing. I think I don't want to say it's a vindictive thing on Lynch's part, but it is a, well, okay, so Michael J. Anderson, who played the Man from Another Place, a.k.a. the Dancing Dwarf, has, by most accounts, gone nuts in the time since Twin Peaks has aired. I don't know if his Facebook page is still up, but he at least at one point did have a Facebook page. He is a very big Trump supporter, which I think is great. And he also posted something implying... Have you seen this, Ethan? He posted something about a year ago saying that Twin Peaks is a confessional statement from David Lynch about raping his daughter, and that Lynch had Jack Nance murdered. That was a thing where, you know, let's just say they seem to have lucked out in saying, when you see me again, it won't be me in the series finale. That was a very fortuitous bit of dialogue, wasn't it? Because now he returns as this creature, this tree with some sort of sack of nerve endings on its head.
I will say that sack, curiously, if you've seen David Lynch, The Art Life, I believe there's at a point where you see him actually painting that or making it out of material. Mm. And it also shows up actually in the Nine Inch Nails video he directed 4 years ago.
Yeah, I was glad to see you point that out. The Black Lodge sequences were called the Came Back Haunted video a fair amount, which I remember when I saw that at the time, I kind of dismissed it because I sort of thought it was... I just didn't think it was particularly good. The music video, I'm saying. But yeah, the fact that he was able to sort of incorporate that into the auteurist canon is...
Yeah.
Yeah, no. That was a real source of pleasure. Now, I guess, yeah. What else is there to say? Just the fact that there doesn't seem to be. A friend of mine after we watched this said, you know, imagine a Showtime accountant or somebody, like, looking over the company statements after these first two episodes air, or after they see the first two episodes. Where on the one hand, you I suppose you know what you're getting when you are hiring Lynch in 2017 to make a project. But still, I don't know. It's this would feel odd and opaque if it was in an art house theater. So the fact that it's on Showtime and that there is this there was this advertisement for some stand-up comedian show that will be canceled within 6 months is, I don't know, it feels like kind of a miracle, and it feels like a Trojan horse in a way. I mean, you know, there's, again, they probably knew what they were getting into, but the fact that this is happening is,
Well, all that matters is they got those subscribers, you know.
No, definitely. I mean, I don't think before this I'd ever seen more than half an hour of Showtime continuously. Mm-hmm. And this summer I will be watching 18 hours of it with fresh eyes. And then, I mean, I've already technically seen close to 4 hours because I watched the two episodes and then I rewatched large sections of them this morning. It'll hopefully pay off. I have to really give my hats off to the network because they are doing something that feels kind of unprecedented.
Props.
Yeah. Also, my fellow Pedro Costa fan, did you think of Horse Money with the figure in the jail cell?
Oh, shit, which I can't believe we didn't even bring that up. That was one of the moments when I was watching, the friend I was watching it with, like, actually, like, kind of gasped and mm-hmm. looked over at me at that moment.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, no. I thought of the elevator scene in Horse Money, which I don't know. I have no idea. I feel like David Lynch has not seen Horse Money since he doesn't even really watch movies. But that was that was the sort of thing that has no real, at the moment doesn't have a clear place inside anything that we've seen thus far. And I do think of, you know, there's been this talk already of being a television critic, TV recapper, who's going to be writing about this for the next, you know, 3.5 months.
Good luck.
Good luck, yes.
And everyone else, and good luck to everyone podcasting as well.
Good luck to everyone podcasting. Yeah, well, here we are. One of my only, I don't want to say grievances, but one of my only reservations is that there's something about it where I wonder how conducive to the experience it will be to watch this week by week, just because it seems he wasn't really kidding when he called this an 18-hour feature, at least with regards to watching parts 1 and 2 as they aired on cable, because there is no break point to it. There's none. And so much so that I, during the end credits, when the cast is listed separately for part 1 and part 2, I found myself keeping an eye out because I was thinking, okay, where exactly did we start with part 2?
I'll say, I mean, I watch it on a live stream from Crave TV, the Canadian streaming service, which you should try if you're in Canada, the promotion. There was actually a break. I can't remember the exact point, but it did cut to the giant and then the record player, and the credits went over the record player. But I can't tell you what was... I think it was right after the first Matthew Lillard confrontation.
With his wife?
Oh, no, with the detective, when he's like, where were you?
Yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, another thing, actually, that reminds me, I think we should bring up two things. One is... I want to talk about the cinematography of this show. Because I felt that the experience suffered a bit from watching it on a cable stream, because it looked pretty compressed, the Showtime stream, I should say. And then when I was rewatching it on their website, I found that the quality was fairly improved. I feel like that's worth bringing up. I don't know how it was for you, but when I watch it on Showtime Anytime, which is basically their version of HBO Go, it looks quite nice, but otherwise that's another thing that Lynch himself was talking about, that he kind of wants their... He's a little worried just about the fact that they're... When you're going to be watching it, you're going to be watching it in sort of a compromised format. He has come out and said as much. I am curious how it looked for you.
Again, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, the stream was not the best. Lots of digital noise. And I was kind of on the edge of my seat that it was going to start buffering during, like, a pivotal sequence, or specifically a Lynch formalist sequence, but I lucked out at least on that regard. But I am, I skimmed through the episodes again through an HD source before this, and yeah. Mwah.
No, it looks nice. I do think there are certain sequences where I find myself vying for maybe a little bit more in one direction, a bit more celluloid or a bit more digital. Certain sequences I found the lighting... So I found some of the interior lighting during daytime sequences maybe a bit flat. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But I found there was much more expressivity to the nighttime sequences, both outdoors and indoors, sort of those rich browns and blacks that I think work quite well. Yeah, and there's definitely some digital... I don't know quite what you'd call it, but there's a bit of digital smear when there's some like sudden actions. If a character falls, for instance, I noticed that. I was thinking how, yeah, I mean, that kind of is what it is. Like, I guess I'm just willing to deal with it because compositionally and sound design-wise, it's still quite nice. So it's, you know, it is what it is. But sound design-wise, I was very intrigued by the fact that there's almost no music through this whole 2 hours. The only Bottle Lamenti music cues I heard, I think, were pre-existing. Of course, there's the theme song, but then there's sort of the shuffling music when it goes to Las Vegas briefly over an establishing shot, and then that's kind of it. And what else is there from the Bottle Lamenti front?
Yeah, not that much that I can think of, other than the pop songs. But there's still 14 more hours, and apparently there's going to be music by Johnny Jewel as well. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, is there more music in episodes 3 and 4?
Yes.
More Bottle Lamenti music?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. I don't know, it's... It's funny, too, how there's been this... I guess I would sort of caution against the initial reactions I was seeing, because people were kind of celebrating as if it's obviously a knock out of the park, but I would say there are 16 more hours to go. I mean, I appreciate the enthusiasm, and I share a lot of it, but I also just was seeing it, and I was like, guys, we've still got a long way to go here. Like, it is possible it could sort of veer out of control, for all we know. However, I will say that the last sequence of the second part slash first episode, I'm considering this all one episode, but the last sequence of last night's broadcast felt like sort of a victory lap in a way, having the musical performance play over those end credits. There's something about it that felt, it felt like a great release in a way. Almost a way of thanking people for letting the show come back, and also kind of a reward for sitting through some particularly languid stretches, which were eerily silent.
Kind of like how Inland Empire ends with that the Cinnamon dance sequence.
Yeah, I thought of that, definitely.
Well, do you want to give any predictions for the next few episodes?
No, not really.
I will say I do think we will see by the end the Garmin-Bosia planet.
Okay.
Because okay. I can't remember if it was Robert Engels or Harley Payton said when they were kind of just tossing around ideas for season 3, when there was the slight chance of it happening, they said maybe there'd be a creamed corn planet. And I think it'd be dope if we actually saw that. And
yeah, sure.
I honestly wouldn't put it past Lynch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wonder how much it's in the show's budget, but who knows? Who knows? Yeah.
Well,
we'll see. Otherwise, no, I have no... otherwise, I have no predictions.
Okay.
I'm just willing to let it pass along.
Focus on the donut, not the hole.
Precisely.
And
thank you.
Okay, well, I think that was a very successful first episode for these first 2 hours, and we can't wait to do this throughout the summer. So, this has been Ethan.
This has been Nick.
And thank you for listening.